I'm David Crowe. Thank you for tuning in to episode 51 of The Infectious Myth. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions for future guests, you can email me at david.crowe@theinfectiousmyth.com. You can like us and participate in discussions at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth, or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. We're on iTunes and other podcast programs, so you can listen live Tuesday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, or you can listen as a podcast afterwards. Remember that I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you do send in a comment with your mailing address, letting me know how you're staying in touch with the show, I will send you a small gift. Today's guest, Professor Emeritus Garth Nicholson, is the President, Chief Scientific Officer, and Research Professor of Molecular Pathology at the Institute for Molecular Medicine in Huntington Beach, California. He is also a conjoint professor at the University of Newcastle in Australia, formerly David Bruton Jr. Chair in Cancer Research and Professor and Chairman of the Department of Tumor Biology at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, and Professor of Internal Medicine and Professor of Pathology and Laboratory Medicine at the University of Texas Medical School at Houston. He was also Professor of Comparative Pathology at Texas A&M University. Professor Nicholson has published over 640 medical and scientific papers, has edited 20 books, and has served on the editorial boards of 30 medical and scientific journals, and was a senior editor of four of these. Professor Nicholson has won many awards, such as the Burroughs Wellcome Medal of the Royal Society, the U.S. National Cancer Institute Outstanding Investigator Award, and the Innovative Medicine Award of Canada. He's also a colonel of the U.S. Army Special Forces and an honorary U.S. Navy SEAL for his work on armed forces and veteran illnesses. Welcome to the show, Professor Nicholson.
Well, thanks for having me on your show.
And can I call you Garth from now on? That's a little easier.
Either that or Professor Nicholson. That's what you call me.
If you'd prefer Professor Nicholson, I can do that.
That's fine.
Okay. So can you describe what the Gulf War syndrome is? And maybe before you do that, since it's been a long time, maybe you can describe what the Gulf War was first.
Well, I think most people know what the Gulf War was, but most people don't realize that the casualties from the Gulf War, and they were quite a few, resulted not only from their exposures in the conflict, but also from exposure to military vaccines and some other things that happened to them during the Gulf War. So you put all that together, and it resulted in a very complex series of different illnesses that we call collectively Gulf War illnesses that affected some 250,000 members of our armed forces, and that's quite a high percentage of the people that were deployed, in fact, much higher than any other conflict.
And how does it compare to the actual number of American soldiers killed or wounded in the war from, like, more traditional things like gunshots and bombs and things like that?
Well, there were only really about 300 KIAs or killed in action during that conflict in 1991. So this represents a very high number, about 18% of the deployed forces that came down with various illnesses after the war. That's a very high percentage.
And what were some of the symptoms of this syndrome? Because it was a syndrome, not a specific disease. So there were a variety of things that people experienced.
Well, we say collectively there were several illnesses that resulted from the Gulf War. Some of these were due to chemical exposures, even a few, maybe even radiologic exposures from depleted uranium. But by far the majority that we found were due to exposures to chronic infections. And most of these, we think, were obtained from the multiple military vaccines that they received during deployment.
And what were some of the vaccines that were given to soldiers in the Gulf War?
Well, they received, we don't have a complete list because some of them were experimental, but they received a full array of vaccines, including vaccines to protect them against biological warfare agents like anthrax. And in fact, the anthrax vaccine was one of the most questionable vaccines that they received.
I mean, was there evidence that the anthrax vaccine actually protected people, or did it just generate antibodies? Like, how effective, how solid was the science behind it?
Well, there was no direct evidence that the anthrax vaccine protected these deployed soldiers. The only evidence that they had really came from studies with volunteers well before the conflict, years before the conflict, where they received various vaccines and then they were exposed to anthrax spores.
Okay.
Well, I should say there was no evidence that anthrax was ever released during the conflict.
Right. I guess in the Second Gulf War, the whole search for weapons of mass destruction basically turned up empty. But the anthrax vaccine, soldiers did not have an option of declining the vaccine, correct?
Correct.
So they could be charged with, disobeying an order or something if they refused to get the vaccine.
That's correct. And in fact, the vaccines were given in a schedule which was very illness-provoking. That is, they received some 30 or so vaccines within a three-day period, both the primary and boosters, and that's just unprecedented in terms of causing immunosuppression. So most of these people were immunosuppressed by the vaccines they received during deployment, and that left them wide open for a number of different common infections or even unusual infections.
Vaccines are supposed to strengthen the immune system. I think it's Paul Offit who said that the human body could take 10,000 vaccines and not have a problem.
That depends on the schedule that the vaccines are given. If you give them all at once, that's not true at all. It's very immunosuppressive. So the way you normally give vaccines and the way they did it during the Second Gulf Conflict, of which they had far, far fewer casualties that we could report as Gulf War illness, was that they spaced these out over 6 months to a year. And that resulted in a tremendous decrease in the number of casualties that they could record as Gulf War illnesses.
Okay. And you believe that mycobacteria play a leading role in these diseases, is that correct?
Well, what we found was that a specific class of intracellular bacteria called mycoplasma was involved, because we found that in about half the ill veterans that came back. And then when it spread to their family members, we found it in virtually all those families where the illness had spread and the adults were coming down with similar signs and symptoms and the children were becoming autistic and had other problems as well.
How do you detect mycoplasma?
Well, we were using a molecular technique called gene tracking. We also developed a PCR, polymerase chain reaction, molecular technique to detect it, and we could detect it from the blood samples that they gave us.
And can you describe a little bit more about gene tracking? I understand PCR. I think most people who listen to the show would understand PCR, but I've never heard of gene tracking.
Gene tracking just involves isolation from the nuclei of white blood cells, in this case obtained from the blood, and separating the nucleoproteins out and then blotting the nucleoproteins with a gene sequence to identify what genes were present.
And so you're looking for genes that you believe are unique to the mycoplasma and not found in the human being normally.
Well, what we did was, when we started out, we had no idea what the problem was, and so we were screening through infections. The reason we centered on infections was the illnesses were passing to the family members, and that could only be biological, which meant it could only be some kind of infection that was being passed. And although that doesn't explain all the illnesses, probably about one half the illnesses were explainable this way. And those individuals and their family members were coming down with similar signs and symptoms of chronic nature, very similar to chronic fatigue syndrome or myalgic encephalopathy. And so what we did was we started looking for agents that we had found previously in these types of disorders. And one of the agents that we looked at was mycoplasma, and we did find mycoplasma in them. In fact, we found it in about half the soldiers that we and Marines that we tested. And I should say we tested not only soldiers and Marines, but also airmen, and we even had a few Coast Guard personnel that we tested. So right. All the people that we tested and Navy personnel that came down with the illness after the war, about half of them showed evidence of mycoplasma. And the interesting thing was it was a very unusual species of mycoplasma that we found. It wasn't the common one that's found, which is Mycoplasma pneumoniae, responsible for most atypical childhood pneumonia cases. This was an unusual one called Mycoplasma fermentans. And so that sort of led us to wonder why this unusual species was present, and we investigated that further. Probably won't go into the details on that.
But right.
This was the same species of mycoplasma that was passed to the family members, immediate family members who became sick. Now, not everybody in a family when the Gulf War veteran returned home, became subsequently sick. But at least more than half of them did, and the ones that did become sick, all of them, essentially all of them, had the same infection that we found in the Gulf War veteran. So we're pretty sure that that was causing the illness.
So you're talking about...
The family member.
Right, you're talking about 100,000 or so family members of Gulf War soldiers who became sick.
No, I didn't say that. I said of the families where the illnesses were present, almost all of them had the same infection. Now, we're quite sure how many, in terms of thousands, of immediate family members became sick because we didn't have that information. But what we did have was in the Marines and U.S. Army personnel that we tested, primarily the source of our family study, we looked at over 100 families. Mm-hmm. And in those 100 families, we found a very, very high percentage, almost all of them, had the same infection as the veteran.
And has there been widespread testing for Mycoplasma fermentans in, like, the general population to see what the background rate is of this disorder?
Well, there hasn't been widespread, but there's been enough testing to know that there's a small percentage, a few percent, that come up positive, and they could be carriers, for example. It's very well known in infectious disease circles that there's a certain percentage of people that may carry an infection but have no symptoms.
But in the case of people with Gulf War syndrome, I mean, some of these soldiers got very, very sick, right?
Correct.
And
some of them died. Thousands of them died, actually.
Yeah.
And that figure, final figure, is still being kept a secret. It's classified. I mean, we had some information, first from the VA, that about 6,000 died, and then from another source within the DOD, it was up to 29,000. So we don't know exactly how many people ultimately died of these illnesses, and some people got very sick. And they had, a lot of them had some very unusual neurodegenerative diseases, for example, like ALS. Now, I did a study on veterans with ALS.
Mm-hmm.
These were ALS cases that were classified as early onset because normally, you know, you're middle age before you come down with the symptoms of ALS.
Right, right.
These were all very young, less than 25. And 100% of them had infections with this Mycoplasma fermentans. So we thought that that was very important. And then we started studying civilian cases of ALS where they had no connection whatsoever with the military. And there we found 85% of those individuals had not the same species of Mycoplasma, but other species of Mycoplasma.
Right.
Different genuses, but the same, different species, but the same genus of Mycoplasma.
Is it possible that these Mycoplasma are opportunistic infections, that they're taking advantage of a weakened host?
They can be. That's certainly true. They're not very infectious compared to something like influenza.
Mm-hmm.
They're a very poorly transmitted infection. They can be transferred airborne, or what we think of the families, fluids may have passed this to the spouses, sexual contact, for example, or mouth kissing, mouth-to-mouth kissing, so on.
Right, right.
But they can be airborne. They can be passed through fluid exchange.
And in these families, what was the severity of illness in the non-soldier family members as opposed to the soldiers?
Not as severe as the veteran, but severe enough to be categorized as chronic fatigue syndrome in adults. The children were very interesting because they had a variety of different problems that generally classify as neurobehavioral disorders, like autism spectrum disorders, for example,
mm-hmm.
one of the most common diagnoses. And these are learning disability disorders, and there were also a few that had attention deficit disorders and so on. So there were a number of childhood neurobehavioral problems in these families. And the interesting thing was when these children were adequately treated, this all went away.
Treated with antibiotics?
Treated with antibiotics and supplements that we recommended to help build back the immune system. And so
okay.
I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the other things that we use. But
yes, yeah. At the end, we'll talk about some of your treatments. For this. Now, somewhere I read that your daughter was in the Gulf War. Was she in the military? Or?
Yes, she was. She was in the 101st Airborne Division. She was forward deployed into Iraq. And she was a crew chief on a Black Hawk helicopter. So she was one of the people that came down with it, one of the reasons we got involved in the first place.
Yeah, and what kinds of symptoms, if you don't mind me asking, what kind of symptoms did she have?
Well, let me just talk in general terms.
Yeah, okay.
In general terms, the symptoms are chronic fatigue and debilitating fatigue, for example, digestional problems, neurologic symptoms, such as brain fog, loss of short-term memory, a number of other cognitive problems, for example. And a number of other difficulties, skin manifestations, blotches and unusual skin rashes and so on, and breathing difficulties and, you know, a number of other problems, gastrointestinal problems, as I mentioned.
Right. I mean, some of these could be confused, like the neurological problems could be confused with PTSD or something like that. What were the things that were kind of diagnostic for Gulf War Syndrome, or was there anything that really stood out as...
Well, that's why it was called a syndrome, because there was nothing that was, I would say, was characteristic that you could say was due to this particular disease. They had, you know, a lot of their problems were general problems that they had. You know, if you look at it, we did, if you look on our website, for example, there's an illness survey form that we used with 120 signs and symptoms. And the Gulf War veterans who were really sick would tick off generally 60 to 80 of those symptoms.
Right.
So they had a wide, multi-symptom problems, and not specific to any organ, not specific to any tissue, and widespread problems.
And at first, if I recollect, at first there was kind of a lot of denial that there were any problems at all. It was just like individuals who happened to have illnesses, but nothing in really in common. But now it seems to be a lot more widely accepted that it was a real syndrome.
Well, it is widely accepted, although when it first started happening, they denied everything.
Yes.
There were no illnesses and so on, and then they grudgingly admitted that there were some illnesses, but they were not serious or whatever, and they weren't related to deployment. And then finally, this goes on and on and on, until finally they admitted that some of these people were pretty severely ill with neurodegenerative diseases, and many of them ultimately died in this group.
Right, and was there special compensation at any point, or did that ever happen, or just they're covered by veterans if benefits?
Well, they just got the general veterans disability, you know, and again, most of them would put in for disability payments, and they would be scored at their local VAs, for example, on what percentage of disability they could obtain.
Right.
Story into itself that I'm not going to get into.
Yes. Yes. You've also talked a lot and studied mitochondrial dysfunction. Is this, do you think this is related to the Gulf War Syndrome?
Well, it's related to practically all chronic illnesses are related to mitochondrial dysfunction. To your listeners, the mitochondria are the little batteries inside our cells that provide the energy for every function that we do, every function our tissues do, or every function essentially that we do, and 80 to 90% of our energy needs are supplied through mitochondrial respiration. This is why we need oxygen. So the mitochondria consume the oxygen and burn metabolites and convert them to energy, and it goes on inside the mitochondria in the inner mitochondrial membrane.
And they have their own DNA, which is also pretty important.
Yeah, they have their own DNA, which supplies a few of the components of the mitochondria, mostly the ones that are very important for this electron transport chain that converts into energy. So in this process, these become very important in terms of health, vitality, energy, longevity, so on and so forth. For example, you can lose mitochondrial function as you age. In fact, most people, after they're 80 or 90, lose about half their mitochondrial function. This is one reason why people that are old are fatigued more easily, and they don't have the vitality or stamina as a younger person. So these little mitochondria degrade over time, they get damaged, and that's one of the things that happens during neurodegenerative diseases in particular, but practically any disease, they'll get damaged.
Right. I mean, every living cell has mitochondria, right?
That's correct. And the reason that your nervous, central nervous and peripheral nervous system is so sensitive to this is that it has about at least six times the energy needs that a normal tissue might have. So it requires a lot of energy, and if the mitochondria are not functioning properly, then that energy isn't there, and then they start to not function properly, and causes all kinds of problems.
So your neurological health will decline faster than your physical health if you have a mitochondrial dysfunction?
Well, it could, and particularly if the mitochondrial dysfunction is localized within the central nervous and peripheral nervous systems.
Right. And so how does mitochondrial dysfunction connect to Gulf War syndrome? Like you'd mentioned chemicals, radiation, as well as these mycobacteria. So are they all related to mitochondria or just some of them?
They are in different degrees. For example, chemical exposure can result in mitochondrial membrane damage. Infections can result in mitochondrial membrane damage. And we know this, for example, in Lyme disease, which has nothing to do with the Gulf War, but is a multiple infections, including one of the similar type of infection that we found in the Gulf War, mycoplasma, along with Borrelia and Bartonella and Babesia and a number of other infections. And Lyme disease patients have problems with mitochondrial function, just like other patients. So this is why we've been working on mitochondrial function problems, because they have, really, they're directly connected to practically any disease.
Yes. And can vaccines cause mitochondrial dysfunction? As you mentioned infectious diseases.
Well,
what
they
about
can.
Vaccines?
They can, and particularly if the vaccines have any kind of contamination. Now, normally, a minor contaminant in a vaccine wouldn't cause a problem, because if you only receive that one vaccine, it's not a problem. But if you receive 30 vaccines over 3 days, for example, boosters, you're entirely immunosuppressed. If there's any kind of contaminant in the vaccines, you're in trouble, because that contaminant is now free to proliferate and cause problems, whereas ordinarily your immune system would take care of it. When your immune system's suppressed, they just go nuts. They take over.
And so how would, at the cellular level, does mitochondrial dysfunction mean you have fewer mitochondria, or that the mitochondria are not operating as well? How does that
generally
work out?
Generally, they're not operating as well. Generally, it's not a matter of reduction of mitochondria. It's a matter of reduction of their function. So functionally, they're impaired. And in most chronic diseases, for example, where people show a lot of fatigue, we know that the mitochondria are functioning less than half of their normal level. So they're putting out half the amount of energy, for example, that they normally put out. And we know that from the function, which is directly tied to their inner mitochondrial transmembrane potential, which we can actually measure. So we can actually measure this in people by taking a blood sample and looking at the white blood cells, which have mitochondria, and looking at the mitochondrial function in those white blood cells. And we know that if people are very sick, their function goes down.
So at the opposite end, like if you had athletes or somebody else that has a greater capacity to harness energy, do they have more mitochondria or better mitochondria?
They can have both, actually. But in general, their mitochondria are very efficient, very effective. In some cases, they have more of them. But it's really a matter of function, because even if you have more and if they're not functioning at a high level, you're just going to have less energy available.
Right. And so you've described that mitochondria, I mean, do they directly cause neurological damage, or is it the lack of oxygen that's consequent, or the lack of energy? How do they...
Well, it's lack of energy, and the lack of energy means that they can't perform all the functions that are necessary. One of the major functions of nerve cells, for example, is to provide polarity of their membranes so they can actually shunt messages along the membrane. They can actually do nerve transmission, and that's caused by depolarization of the membrane, and that depolarization requires that the membrane become polarized to begin with, and that requires what are known as pumps to pump ions back and forth across the membrane. And that requires energy. Those pumps just don't work out of anywhere. They require energy to operate.
All right. I've interviewed other people on the show, and some of them have also talked about mitochondrial dysfunction, and other things that I've read have blamed low-fat diets, methanol-containing aspartame, and vaccinations. Well, you've talked about that. Do you think those are alternate causes, or
these things can cause damage to mitochondrial membranes. The inner mitochondrial membrane, the mitochondria has two membranes. So there's an outer membrane, which is kind of a filter, and an inner membrane, which is where the energy production occurs. And this inner membrane turns out to be very sensitive to oxidative damage. And so things that produce what we call reactive oxygen species, or ROS, can damage that inner mitochondrial membrane, oxidize it, and damage the lipids primarily in the membrane, cause the inner membrane to become leaky or dysfunctional, and then it doesn't operate at the same level. So there are a number of things that can do that. Infections can cause that. Chemicals can cause that. Different things can cause it. So a wide variety of different environmental exposures can cause mitochondrial dysfunction.
Yeah, I think in one of my recent shows, I talked to somebody about fluoroquinolone antibiotics. I don't know if those were used in the Gulf War. They might be more recent than that. But she was talking about damage to the mitochondria from those in people who have severe reactions to those.
Sure. And in fact, damage can occur to mitochondria. It occurs all the time. It's how effective you are at repairing the damage that determines whether your mitochondria are going to be dysfunctional or not. Everybody has mitochondrial damage. We get
right.
it naturally.
Right, and when
But we have natural mechanisms for repairing that damage, and if those mechanisms aren't operating properly, that's what causes us the problems. We can't reconstitute our full function, and that's what's causing the problem. So that got us into figuring out how can we reconstitute the mitochondrial function. And we've and others have found that the lipids in the mitochondrial inner membrane are most sensitive to oxidative damage. So those have to be replaced, and they're very specific types of lipids.
Mm-hmm.
And they require very specific nutritional supplementation to, in fact, replace those specific lipids. And so we're not talking about general fats or general lipids, because that's something much more specific than that.
Yes. Oh, I was going to ask you if you could get into your lipid replacement therapy idea. Like, what kinds of lipids are you using, and how do they work at helping the mitochondria?
Well, generally we use membrane glycerol phospholipids. So these are the types of lipids that are present in your membranes to begin with. They're
mm-hmm.
not anything new that has to be broken down or complex right. fats or whatever. These are very specific membrane lipids, phospholipids. So what we do is we provide patients not only with the specific lipids they need, but provide them in a form that's protected so the lipids don't get damaged, because these lipids are very sensitive to damage. So a lot of the lipid products that people buy in stores and everything that have all this advertising behind them are just junk in terms of the damage to the lipids during their storage, for example, or during their ingestion. And so people take in a lot of junky lipids, and those don't help at all. In fact, they make it worse. So what you need are these pristine membrane glycerol phospholipids that can replace the damaged lipids in our inner mitochondrial membranes, among
right.
one membranes of the cell that have to be exchanged out.
How do you protect fats? I mean, they still have to be absorbed through the intestine, right? So they can't be like enclosed in as a pill, right? Each molecule still has to be absorbed. So how does the lipid get protected?
Well, we have actually two mechanisms for taking in lipids because of our evolution
mm-hmm.
as hunter-gatherers types, you know, where we feast famine, and we were periods during our evolution where we would take in a lot of fat, for example, after a kill, and then go for long periods without any intake at all. So we
mm-hmm.
have to have, turns out we have two mechanisms. One is a mechanism that takes in single molecules. Another is a mechanism which actually takes in the appropriate lipid droplets from our intestinal system. So we, in fact, feed people with essentially lipid droplets that are protected with very specific molecules in a patented process. These specific biological molecules, there's nothing chemical about it. They're biological, and they protect the lipids during their absorption. And these get transported to cells where there are very specific molecules that can pick them up and shuttle them to various membranes of the cell. And once they're being shuttled, they're protected by their binding to these proteins or other lipoprotein carriers, as they're
right.
called, and they're just shuttled around to different places where they're needed. So the important thing, is to bring in the right kind of lipid, because these are all kind of passive mechanisms for transport in within our systems. They're
mm-hmm.
not entirely specific. So we need to provide the right kinds of lipids, and we need to protect those lipids from oxidative damage.
Right. And so you're actually providing the individual lipids, but in a natural diet, what kinds of foods contain some of the lipids that you're that you're trying to get to people in
well,
sort of therapeutic...
Well, there are a lot of different sources. For example, fish oils, krill mm-hmm. oils, things like that contain, you know, the appropriate kinds of lipids. The problem is they contain a lot of junky lipids, too.
Right.
And if they're not protected, they get, you know, it's just like fish can become rancid very quickly. Fish oils can become rancid very quickly, which means generally they're oxidized
right.
and damaged. And then they're really junky lipids, and they're not going to help at all. They make matters worse. So it's really important to maintain these lipids in a non-oxidized state, not only during their storage, but in their uptake in the
right.
gastrointestinal system and during their transfer. And that's the important thing, and that's what we've done in terms of developing new products to help patients with these problems.
Right. I guess where I was going is, if let's say that you're a healthy person and you want to have a better diet, do you need these supplements, or are there, you know, foods that would help improve your diet by getting you these lipids in a natural way, or do you think that we just don't absorb them?
Well, of course, there are appropriate diets and everything which can help you maintain the level. And if you're healthy, you're probably okay. But if you're not healthy, if you're sick in any way, then you may be impaired in terms of your ability to take in these lipids and to get them to the right places where they're needed and to protect them during the process. And so that's what we provide. We have a product that's called NT Factor, and this is a protected membrane phospholipid mixture. And when people take this, their phospholipids in this are protected in their digestive system, and they're taken in and transported. And it allows the delivery of these unoxidized, undamaged lipids to the mitochondria and other organelles in the cell. So the membranes can be repaired. There's a natural repair process, but they need the right kinds of lipids, and they
All
need
right.
them in the right state.
And I presume that you've tested these on people with Gulf War syndrome, and what kinds
oh, yeah.
of responses have you had?
We've tested them on people with chronic infections, with anything from Gulf War, chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia syndrome, neurobehavioral diseases in children, for example. With autism spectrum disorders and adults with neurodegenerative diseases and so on. In all these cases, we've seen improvements and increases in mitochondrial function in all these patients that have taken, for example, NT factor lipids.
And, you know, what for somebody who's been seriously disabled, say, by the Gulf War syndrome or something similar, like how close do they get back to their original health when they do this?
Well, in a lot of these different illnesses, there are multiple factors that are involved, and this is just one of the factors. The factors that lead to fatigue, for example, and some of the other brain deficits. But there are a number of different factors, and so this helps, but it's no panacea. All these different diseases are what we call multifactorial. They have a number of different causes, and there are a number of different solutions that have to be used together to help somebody recover. So there's no quick fix.
Right.
But this does help people that have these problems with fatigue and also have problems with cognition and short-term memory loss and some of the other problems that they have associated with them. But it's not going to help with everything.
Right. Yeah, well, it always makes me suspicious when somebody promotes something as a 100% cure for everything. That always seems a little too good to be
true.
Well,
you know, they're generally wrong when that's,
yes.
There's hardly anything which is 100% cure for anything.
Yes.
Because people with chronic illnesses, in general terms, have a number of different problems.
Mm-hmm.
And this being one of them, one of their problems, but they have other problems. But we can help fix this particular problem, and this leads to really great improvement in the quality of life and more energy, more vitality, and so on. So it's very useful. It's also very useful anti-aging substance that people can take because we found that elderly people do extremely well on the anti-factor lipids. They regain function in terms of mental function, but they also regain physical function because they have more health, vitality, energy, spark to their lives, and so on and so forth. So it's really very useful.
It seems
not only for people that are ill, but also people that have, you know, loss of function over time or for various other reasons.
Yes, it seems like the normal approach to aging is to just increase the number of prescriptions every year until somebody can't take it anymore. One of the in a paper that you sent me, one of the lipids is alpha lipoic acid, and you mentioned that it's both a potent antioxidant and also a metal ion chelator. So
a weak one, but it does help.
Right.
So again, that's another type of lipid which is useful. Again, there are a variety of different things, and that's why I sent you the article, just to show you what kinds of different things have been used as supplements, and all these have a certain incremental ability to help, including the lipid replacement therapy. But you need to look at all these different aspects of health. I hate the word holistically, but you need to look at it
right.
In terms of the general uses of these various supplements. There is no real panacea here, but what it does do is little by little, it helps people regain their function. So you correct something here, you correct something there, and so on and so forth, and little by little you help them have a better life, have a better quality of life,
right.
And have more function.
Do you think that many of the people with these neurodegenerative diseases also had an excess load of toxic metals? Like some of these, I don't know how many of the 30 vaccines contained a thimerosal, for example, which contains mercury, and weapons contain a lot of exotic metals. Like, was there a load of toxic metals in these people as well as other things?
Well, there were some, and in particular, some of the people, for example, were exposed to depleted uranium, which was particularly nasty heavy metal,
right?
Which does tend to mobilize into your bones, and so you have to get it out of there, and it's a slow process, and of course it's radioactive, and so that's a double whammy.
Right,
you get
right.
The effects of the heavy metal, and then you get the effects of the radioisotope as well. So in those people, that you know, we have to get that heavy metal out of there. So that's another story, but. That goes hand in hand in a way with some of these other exposures.
Right.
And so we do have to worry about heavy metal contamination and its removal. So it's not something that we can divorce from this picture at all.
Right. No, I understand. But if you get the uranium while it's in the bloodstream and it gets excreted, then the damage is limited. But if it gets into the bones, is it possible to get rid of it, or is it just there forever?
Well, again, it's slowly. It's a very slow process. To mobilize it from the bone and get rid of it, eliminate it.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very slow and difficult process. So a lot of these people, it takes literally years to get rid of this contamination if it's occurred.
Right.
And, so, you know, we know that from factory workers that have been contaminated with heavy metal. It takes a long time to get it out of your body.
Right, and I guess the sooner you get on it, like if somebody is 10 years out from their exposure before they start working on it, it's a whole lot more difficult than if...
Well, it is, because, you know, a lot of these metals have worked their way deep into the tissues and cells, and it just takes a lot to get it out, and it's a very slow process, and during the process of mobilization, people can also become very sick due to the mobilization, and so, it's a very slow and tedious process, but it can be done.
Right, and I know, for some reason, the whole issue of chelation, like, I first heard of chelation as kind of this alternative voodoo medicine thing that people turn their noses up. But, I mean, chelation is just basically saying that there's metals in your body that we want to get rid of. Do you think that your protocol does a lot of chelation, or it's just kind of a side benefit? And have you looked at chelation in more detail?
Well, it's a side issue for what we're concentrating on. Mm-hmm. But a lot of other people are working on that, so I don't worry so much about that, because
right.
Plenty of people are working on that particular problem. So what we're working on is the problem of the mitochondria and other membranes of the cell, like the nerve membranes,
mm-hmm.
for example, and how to restore their function. So you can't do everything.
No,
we're
no.
We're well aware of the problems of heavy metals and so on, and they do impact on mitochondrial function as well. So we have to be well aware of that. That you can't look at these things in isolation. You have to look at the whole picture. And that's
yes.
part of the picture, and, you know, we have to be aware of it, and when it's present, we have to take care of it.
Well, it seems like it's a lot easier to break down the human body than it is to build it up again.
Well, it's a lot easier to destroy things than it is to build them, that's for sure.
That's always the case. And so what are some of the other disorders that you've, you mentioned a few of them, but what are some of the other disorders that you tested your lipid replacement therapy on?
Well, one of the things that we're doing most recently is we're looking at the people that have chemical contamination. So we started with some veterans from as far back as Vietnam to more recent wars, mm-hmm. Where people were chemically exposed, either due to their workplace handling chemicals, for example, or they were in a battlefield situation where they were exposed to chemicals, anything from oil well fires to whatever. So these people came back with a pretty heavy chemical load.
Right.
And so we've been using actually high-dose lipid replacement therapy to help remove those chemicals because it turns out one of the major mechanisms for removal of chemicals is that our body will conjugate these offending chemicals with other chemical moieties inside the cells to help them be more capable of being mobilized.
Right.
And it turns out that that means to connect them with molecules that are very lipid-soluble. So if we put in this lipid replacement therapy, we use a lot of excess lipids that are membrane lipids, they can actually sop up some of these conjugated lipids and help remove them, help eliminate them
mm-hmm.
Through natural elimination processes, and that turns out to be very helpful.
So this is things like with, if you're talking the Vietnam War, you're talking about Agent Orange, that kind of exposure?
And a number of other chemicals that were used. You know, the people were contaminated against. Some were petroleum, other-based chemicals or herbicide-based chemicals or so on and so forth.
All right.
There are a number of different things that were used, and people have had a lot of problems because of it. And this actually helps people start to slowly remove them. It's a long, slow process. It doesn't happen overnight. This is not something where, you know, people will take these things and magically they'll get better in days or something like that. So we're talking long-term of solutions to these problems. So people have to be patient, and particularly when you're slowly removing offending chemicals, the same thing is true with heavy metals or other things. You have to do it slowly, and you have to do it steadily. Otherwise, you can cause them to become even sicker than they are.
Right. Like if you suddenly mobilized all of, I mean, I've wondered about this. If you have a dose of pesticides in your, which is normally in your fatty tissues, right?
That's correct.
And so if you were to dump that all into your bloodstream right away, it would probably kill you, right?
Well, it certainly, I don't know, it could, but it could make you extremely sick.
Right.
And so these things have to be removed very slowly, and that's lipid replacement therapy helps in the slow, safe removal of chemicals. That's what we found. And so we're just using that now to treat patients, and very successful. It's again, a very good, not a panacea, but it's a very good adjuvant to some of the existing therapies.
I guess if you're experiencing a slow decline in health, and if this turns around to be a slow improvement in health, that's actually a pretty good thing psychologically as well as physically, because you feel like there's maybe light at the end of the tunnel.
Well, that's true, and these people have been sick a long time, and so they're grateful for any help they can get. And
yes.
If they do, when they do start feeling better, they're very grateful for that.
All right, and you mentioned chemical contaminations that were not military. Like, are these industrial contaminations, or
some are industrial, and some are just accidents that have occurred.
Yeah.
And so, again, in some cases, people were extremely sensitive to particular chemicals, and because of that sensitivity, they became very sick. And not that it was just a total amount; it's just that they were incredibly sensitive to very small amounts. So in that case, we have to even get consider that small amounts in certain individuals can cause illness. And so we have to do everything we can to deplete it from their bodies.
Right. I've heard of, I forget what the name of the syndrome is, but I've heard of people who become very sensitized to certain chemicals, like even like perfumes or something can make them very, very sick.
Yeah. And generally, these people fall in the general category of MCS, or multiple chemical sensitivity. And when that happens, they become sensitive to all kinds of different things. And so, again, it's important to remove the offending chemicals from these individuals because they're so sensitized that even small amounts of certain types of chemicals will just really cause them to become incredibly ill.
And over time, does that cause them to be less sensitive to external chemicals?
Well, we're not sure about that, but they certainly improve in their condition. In their general condition, and if they keep taking the lipid products, for example, I think they can prevent some of the contamination that occurs naturally. And so I think that's important as well.
You know, when I read your bio, you came across as a very mainstream scientist, and you said to me before we started talking that you considered yourself a mainstream scientist. You've published in mainstream journals and edited mainstream journals, and you've worked at pretty mainstream organizations, but you did get some pushback with some of the things you investigated. And can you describe some of that, like how the things that you found that upset some people and what happened?
Well, when we started working on Gulf War illness and found this infection, there was a lot of pushback against that because the infection that we found, and when we started to look at it in more detail, we found some unusual gene sequences in the infection that suggested it might be a biological warfare agent. That really, the bells went off. And when we found those kinds of results, there was an incredible pushback, as you say. Efforts, for example, to discredit us and to shut down our laboratories, and you know, a number of really nasty things were done to us. But we survived that, and that's the important thing.
Yeah.
And you know, went on to do our work.
Yeah, you said you wrote a book about these experiences.
Yeah, the book is called Project Daylily.
Okay.
And, it has a website. It's called Project Daylily, spelled as one word.
Okay.
.com. And people can go on that and read about the book and so on and so forth, and read the reviews on the book and so on.
Right.
And this really tells us about our whole saga with the Gulf War illness question and finding the infections in the Gulf War veterans and all the things that were done to us to keep us quiet and prevent us from reporting it, publishing it, and so on and so forth, and discrediting it and when it was published.
Did you ever get your head around why it was so controversial? Like, did some people in the military think you were accusing them of using biological agents,
You know, a lot of it, the reason that I think it became such a hot issue was that when we got involved in this, there were people coming to us that were civilians who had been exposed before the Gulf War, and the most obvious case was a group of prison guards in Texas at a prison where they were conducting experiments on prisoners. By the way, without their knowledge or approval.
Really?
For the Department of Defense. And these prison guards came to us. Their family members are getting sick. And when we started looking at their diseases, they were very similar to Gulf War illness. And so that's when we started looking for the infection that we found in the Gulf War veterans and found it in those people, only they had really contracted this before the Gulf War. So it suggested that there were experiments going on in the prison systems in the United States using the agents that we found in the Gulf War veterans. And so that really smacks of biological warfare testing, which is illegal and was illegal at the time. And so,
well, not only that, but I mean, it used to be quite common to test things like, I think the polio vaccine, or maybe it wasn't that, maybe there was something before in the 40s or 50s, it was quite common to test things like new vaccines on prisoners. With very little informed consent, but that all
Correct.
Supposedly changed. And so even if somebody's sentenced to death, it's still not fine to go up and inject them with something unknown and not get informed consent. And in fact, how could you get informed consent from somebody in a prison?
Well, in any case, what they did was they bribed the prisoners, from what we heard from the
right.
guards. They would offer them, you know, certain perks, you know, that they wanted, and so they would sign up for these different things. So that's how they got their guinea pigs.
Right.
But the prison guards didn't sign up for it, and they didn't, and their family members who got it, because the guards brought it home, and people worked in the infirmaries, for example, or, you know, whatever, administrative parts of the prisons, they got it too. And these were the people who were really upset about it because they didn't sign up for it.
Right. Well, I mean, I guess that goes for soldiers, too. I'm sure this, you know, soldiers sign up because they feel patriotic or some other motivation like that, or they want to get out of their backwater town and see the world and maybe get some training. But they didn't sign up because they wanted to be exposed to exotic chemicals or radioactive materials or anything like that.
Yet, you know, we found that when people came forward to us, that some of them were, for example, in units, this is before the Gulf War, that were volunteered to go into these different testing programs and so on and so forth. And so the entire unit would be, quote, volunteered, unquote. And, of course, you know, if every, you know, 90% of the people are raising their hands, they're all going to raise their hands.
Right.
So, you know, we found, anyway, I won't go into that. It's in the book.
Right, right.
People can read about it.
Right. Now, if people want to find out more about your research into lipid replacement therapy, where can they go to get more information about that?
Well, they can go to our website, the Institute for Molecular Medicine, which is a nonprofit research organization. It's affiliated with the University of California at Irvine and other places. So it's a freestanding institute. Its website is www.immed.org. It's like a media.org.
Okay.
And people can go there and find information on chronic illnesses and lipid replacement therapy and other subjects that might be of interest to them.
Right. And you said you actually have products. That these are sold by the organization or some other?
No, we don't sell anything. But, you know, it's pretty clear where you can get these products. We just simply give some websites where people can go and investigate the products. We don't sell anything commercially at all.
So there's multiple sources of what you consider to be valuable lipid therapies?
We've concentrated on one source because it's the best source, although there are some other sources that we have, you know, from our publications people can see that we've gotten other sources as well. But a lot of it traces back to this one company in New York, which has the patent for the lipid replacement therapy product called NT Factor. And so virtually all of our studies have used NT Factor or NT Factor lipids, the lipid component of NT Factor,
right,
for our scientific studies.
Right. And what's the name of that company?
Nutritional Therapeutics.
Oh, okay. So that's why the NT.
Yeah.
Okay, I understand. But the information that people get would give them information about the types of lipids that they should be looking for. So it would be possible for people to source alternative.
It's certainly possible. I mean, I don't recommend it because I know that the product that we've been working with, the NT Factor lipids, is the best product that I've seen.
Mm-hmm.
We've looked at a few. But in terms of quality and in terms of the way it's packaged with materials that protect the oxidative damage and so on, predict the fidelity, more or less, of the product. It's very good with that product, and not so much with other products that we've looked at. So that's the one we're recommending.
Yes, and there's no association between Nutritional Therapeutics and the Institute?
No.
Yeah.
We've just conducted clinical trials for them.
Right.
And for other companies like Research Nutritionals, for example. And so we've conducted clinical trials, and we've published the results and so on. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's pretty common.
Right. And have you been able to get government funding for some of these trials? Because I know that nutritional therapies are sometimes not as favored as pharmaceutical therapies when it comes to research funding.
There's really no money available from the government to do these kinds of studies because, you know, they're dietary studies. They consider that these are dietary supplements, and so they're not really, you know, worthy of study compared to, you know, some patented drug or something like that. But again, the government is really not funding studies like that because they expect the pharmaceutical industry, or in this case, the nutraceutical industry, to fund those kinds of studies and fund those clinical trials because they're very expensive.
Well, yes. I mean, it seems like there's a big funding gap because I'm not sure that the nutraceutical companies have the money for the large-scale clinical trials that pharmaceutical companies.
I mean, that's part of the problem is that we really have not had funding to really do large-scale clinical trials. So most of our clinical trials are pretty small because, you know, that's all the funds that we have available from these small companies. They just can't afford a big clinical trial.
Well, I mean, if I was in charge, it would seem to me that you would start with the at least toxic interventions first, which would be dietary, and then move towards artificial chemicals later, but it seems like it's the other way around.
It's the other way around, mainly for profit reasons.
Yes.
There's not as much profit in these natural things, even though, for example, the NT Factor is a patented product now. It's still, the profit is not there compared to a drug. Nowhere near.
Yes.
So this would be, you know, the drugs are hundreds, thousand times more profitable in terms of the profit per product. So that's why, you know, all the effort is in that area.
Yes. And their patent, nutritional therapeutics, I mean, patents are only 17 years. So when their patents run out, anybody could make it, right?
Yeah, that's true. In a few years. There's nothing unusual about it or nothing extraordinary about it at all. Because, again, they're natural. Everything's natural. So anybody can obtain some of these natural products and so on. It's putting them together in the right sequence and the right materials, you know, that's the secret of it.
Right.
Other than that, there's no mystery to it.
Yeah. Well, we've come towards the end of our hour, and I would just like to thank you for a fascinating conversation. We've covered quite a bit of ground, I think, and some thought-provoking ideas from you and some great information.
Yeah, just let me get my website again. It's the
yeah.
Institute for Molecular Medicine. It's www.immed, like immediate, immed.org.
We'll definitely put that in the show notes. So anybody who goes to the website for the Infectious Myth on prn.fm can find those two websites, immed.org and projectdaylily.com. Are there any others that we should include?
Well, the ntfactor.com. If people are interested in the NT Factor, that's a good place for information.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate this conversation. And goodbye.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.